Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants. Well, thank you all for joining us for the inaugural episode of the Journal for American Academy of Physician Assistants podcast. This has been a little bit of a long time coming. Some talking with some professionals online through Twitter and social media kind of brought us all together. Between Harrison Reed, who is associated with JAPA, and then myself, Christopher Madej, and my founding co-host, Adrian Banning. So we're going to just introduce ourselves a little bit before we jump into the articles from the May edition of the journal. So I am Christopher Madej. I am a program director and associate professor at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. I've been here since 2017. And my qualifications for doing this podcast is I am a peer reviewer for JAPA. I'm also on the editorial advisory board for the Journal for Physician Assistant Education. But more specific to this role is I also host my own podcast called the PAIN Podcast, which is an acronym for the Physician Assistant in Education, where I cover PANTS blueprint topics. And that's kind of where my love for podcasting came in and kind of how we all got connected through social media. So my founding co-host is Adrian Banning, who is going to jump in next.
I am. Hi. Like Chris said, my name is Adrian Banning, and we're really happy to be doing this podcast and bringing you more multimedia experience. And thanks to the JAPA editorial board and Deputy Editor Harrison Reed for helping us kind of get this going. So I'm an assistant clinical professor at Drexel University. I'm also a peer reviewer for JAPA and the Journal of Physician Assistant Education and a section editor and feature editor for both of those journals as well. I'm really interested in how we can bring more multimedia into the profession, more social media into the profession, into the classroom. And here at Drexel, I'm our EBM kind of curricular developer and course director. So this idea just seemed to congeal all of those ideas together. And we're just going to jump right in and start talking about the May issue now that you know a little bit more about us and why we're doing this. And one of the first things we're going to talk about is how we're celebrating the 50th year of our profession. And JAPA has several nods to that in this issue. First of all, starting with the editorial by the editor-in-chief, Dr. Rima Bouchard, who brings up how we're all going to be meeting in Las Vegas shortly for the AAPA conference. And he really highlights the parallel but juxtaposition of how there's so much excess in Vegas and we're coming together to celebrate being healthcare providers and forwarding healthcare in the United States, but that we're having this celebration in a place that faces a lot of socioeconomic issues. So Reamer talks about how when he's seeing a patient, he likes to bring evidence to the table, but that's not always the answer to all the problems that his patients face. Reamer is both a pharmacist and a physician assistant, so when he's thinking about medications, he brings up the steps of medications, STEPS, which is safety, tolerability, efficacy, price, and the simplicity of usage. Those five great things to consider when you're writing any medication. But he also shares his frustration that there are so many obstacles that patients face that are beyond his control and beyond thinking about the evidence and steps that are so complicated and create kind of these, my words, but wicked problems, the concept of wicked problems. And Reamer questions, do we often ask about the health inequities that our patients and our students, if you're in PA education, face? And really thinking about the housing conditions. We're going to be in nice digs in Vegas and surrounded by luxury, but it turns out that it's pretty difficult to find affordable housing in Nevada otherwise. How do we overcome these things when there are so many health issues linked to poor housing, like asthma, lead poisoning, clean water access, developmental disorders, mental illness, and injuries? Reamer points out that there's a great CDC resource in Healthy Homes Initiative to be more aware of. And even though it feels impossible, thinking about poor living conditions and asking about the erosion of public health, in Reamer's words, can help us to, quote unquote, examine if we're giving adequate attention to the social factors that affect our patients' health and our students. And he ends by saying, quote, if PAs can better understand where our patients live, learn, work, and play, then we can do more to craft innovative strategies that improve their health and bolster community resources through advocacy efforts and volunteerism. And I think that's kind of key. I agree. We can be one-on-one with any patient and ask about these things, but then when do we take it to a larger level to advocate for the larger socioeconomic problems that we know we can't face alone? So I agree, and thanks to Dr. Bouchard for that great editorial.
Yeah, that's a great article, because from a provider standpoint, you can learn all the medicine and you can treat all the diseases, but if you really just don't understand the framework from where your patient is coming from, it's really hard for you to really advocate the best that you can for your patient population. So when right. you get out into your clinical practice and you see where you're going to be practicing, there's more to it than just showing up and, you know, seeing your patients and trying to staunch out disease as best you can, because we've all been in that situation where we know we need to write this antibiotic and we're going to write it, but it's $50 out of pocket and our patients can't right. afford that. So is it better to write them an antibiotic that they can afford that might work, or the expensive antibiotic we know will work but is not because they can't afford it and won't get it? So this article really does highlight the importance of us as the providers understanding where our patients are coming from.
Right, and showing that you have that concern simply by asking, I think, goes a long way sometimes. So nice reminder.
Absolutely. So we're going to jump into the next article, which is actually one of the featured CME articles, which is a review on cystic fibrosis. And cystic fibrosis is the most common life-shortening disease among Caucasians in the United States. And this is affecting about 30,000 people throughout the country right now and occurs in about one out of every 3,500 births per year. And the pathophysiology that you have to know for your pants and your PANRI is this occurs as a mutation in the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulatory gene, or the CFTR gene. And right now, they've actually identified through genomic research that there's over 2,000 mutations, but the most common mutation is actually at the F508del location, and this accounts for about 70% of all of these mutations for the disease processes that occur. And what happens with this mutation is it actually causes a defective sodium chloride transport across the epithelial cell membranes of the mucous membranes, and this leads to an overproduction and buildup of real thick, tenacious mucus throughout those areas. And the problem with that, obviously, is it's difficult to clear and is a precursor to a lot of bacterial colonization and chronic infections. There are six classes of mutations and defects, and there is a beautifully laid out detailed chart in the article that you can look at in the edition. But it does lay out these six common mutations and the defects that occur and how it affects the overall pathophysiology. So the presentation of your patient who comes in or is being identified with cystic fibrosis revolves mainly around two subsystems. GI, which is going to manifest itself earlier, that can be in newborns as well as infants within the first couple weeks of life, is having a meconium ileus and not having a meconium stool within 48 hours of birth is cystic fibrosis is one of those diseases you want to keep on your differential. But it also can cause pancreatic insufficiency, and this can lead to failure to thrive in the newborn. So if you're seeing an infant in clinic who is just barely skipping along the growth curves or is falling below that, this is a condition that you need to look at, and maybe this was somebody who fell through the cracks from a screening standpoint, which we'll touch on here in a second. Later on in life, you get into the pulmonary complications, and this is chronic cough, wheezing, recurrent pneumonias, bronchiolitis, bronchiectasis, just a lot of pulmonary conditions that can cause a significant amount of morbidity and mortality in your cystic fibrosis patients. Other associated complications that we see, diabetes is very common, again, due to the insulin insufficiency from the pancreatic dysfunction. We can see a lot of pulmonary hypertension with the perfusion of the lungs due to the chronic pulmonary conditions. And spontaneous pneumothorax is actually quoted in the article at around 3%. So if you have a child who comes in with a spontaneous pneumothorax who doesn't fit that classic Marfan's appearance, then maybe, again, you might want to be thinking about cystic fibrosis. How do we diagnose it? Well, in 2010, all 50 states across the country have newborn screening for CF, which is great. And there are two different tests that are performed. We have an immunoreactive trypsinogen, an IRT, which is the screening test, and that's usually done at birth, and a greater than 60 nanogram per milliliter is a positive result, and that is then followed up 2 weeks later with another IRT screening before they then move on to the confirmatory gold standard test, which is your sweat chloride. And what they do is they do a transdermal iontophoresis using pilocarpine, and they're testing again for greater than 60 millimoles per liter. So it's nice for you to remember from a diagnostic standpoint, both the screening and the confirmatory test are going to be greater than 60. One is nanograms per milliliter in your IRT test, and one is millimoles per liter in your sweat chloride test. Radiography can also be used in some of your disease progression and seeing how the disease progresses over time. Chest X-ray is really more beneficial in children because it's obviously less radiation than CT scan. CT will give you a better look, but it's a higher radiation exposure. And the last thing we need to do for these kids with CF is expose them to radiation and increase their risk for malignancy later on. The findings that you see on chest X-ray is hyperinflation. You might see some peribronchial thickening, bronchiectasis, some air trapping. There's a really good image in the article that you can go to look at that. You can also calculate a Brasfield score, which they touch on in the article, which is a quantitatively evaluate score where they're looking at pulmonary progression and is inversely correlated with the disease severity, meaning the lower the score that the patient has, the higher the severity. And this is based off of radiography findings, and they're looking for air trapping, linear markings, nodular cystic lesions, larger lesions, and the overall severity of the image. And this is, again, a quantitative score that they talk about in the article that will, again, allow you to help trend these patients over time and see how their Brasfield score is changing. Pulmonary function tests and arterial blood gases can also be helpful. It'll help you look at the chronic disease progression as well as acute exacerbations, and it will also help you in patients who come in who are acutely hypoxic, just so we can see where they're living at on a day-to-day basis to see whether or not they need oxygen therapy or other acute interventions. So the management of cystic fibrosis is, again, going to revolve around the two main subsystems, and we're going to really revolve around pulmonary because that's where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. Breathing treatments are going to be very, very helpful because, again, they have that thick, tenacious mucus that's being produced inside of their airways. So hypertonic saline nebulized treatments will help break that up and will help the patient be able to expectorate that. Vaccinations, and after you vaccinate some more. You want to make sure that patients are covered not only for influenza, because we can see significant pulmonary complications from influenza every year, but also pneumococcal. We need to try to limit as many common types of infections as possible because these patients are at a higher risk for developing other infections in bacteria that we can't vaccinate against. Pulmonary physical therapy can also be very beneficial. It helps with clearance of that mucus. There's flutter valve therapy, chest percussion, high-frequency vest-assisted compressions. There's a lot of different things out there that basically just help break that stuff up so that the patient can cough it up and get it out. Ibuprofen has actually been shown to help prevent loss of lung function in children. So the anti-inflammatory effect of the ibuprofen can also be helpful in limiting some of the pulmonary progression. Ivacaftor is a new medicine that has come out that is a potentiator for the CFTR gene and helps with opening those channels back up, and it's approved for patients over the age of 6. This is a medicine that is typically reserved for pulmonary specialists and CF specialists, but it is if you're seeing these patients in your clinic for just well child visits or other things and you see this medication, that's what it's used for. And then, of course, a lung transplant is kind of what we use at the end-all, be-all if they fail a lot of the medical management. Because as you can see from the article, The median survival in children is only about 4.7 years after transplant, a little bit better in adults at 7.8. So we want to try to get these kids as far as possible before we start talking about lung transplant to give them as long as possible with their new sets of lungs. The GI management is going to revolve around pancreatic enzyme supplementation to make sure that they're getting their appropriate amylase and lipase to help with their food digestion, as well as insulin therapy due to the pancreatic insufficiency and insulin deficiency. Now, the prognosis for CF, it has been steadily increasing over the last 20 years, and right now it's up to about 40 years of age, which is phenomenal. And it's predicted to get to 50 years of age for children that are currently diagnosed right now. So over the next decade or so, we're really seeing a pretty significant advancement in patients who have been diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. The next article we're going to jump into is the pharmacology consult. And the question that was posed in this particular article was, does low-dose methotrexate deserve more respect from clinicians? The short answer is absolutely. In the article, they talk about medication errors caused by methotrexate, and 47% of all serious medication errors are caused by seven drug classes, with methotrexate being the number one in incidence. So there's a lot of complications that go on with this medicine, not just regular dosing, but also low dosing. And it's still associated with a significant amount of drug-drug interactions as well as toxicities. Now, for a quick review of the pharmacodynamics of methotrexate, it is a competitive inhibitor of dihydrofolic acid reductase, which interferes with DNA synthesis and cellular reproduction. This all leads to binding of serum proteins so that other protein-bound medications can then cause systemic toxicity. So the methotrexate that is in the system binds to these proteins, and then it makes other drugs that the patient is taking maybe getting to toxic levels. It's also renally cleared, so any medication affecting renal tubular secretion can cause systemic toxicity of that medication as well. So there's a lot that goes into this medicine, and even low-dose methotrexate can cause a significant amount of complications. So the bottom line is respect the dosing, do a thorough medication review before you start any methotrexate, and when in doubt, consult your friendly neighborhood pharmacist to do a thorough med reconciliation to make sure you're not missing something.
Yeah, I think, Chris, I really like a lot of the points that you hit in both of those articles. I think unless you're a relatively new grad, that universal screening for CF is something pretty new, just from 2010. So to think about the universal screening, but remember, it doesn't mean that just because someone's screened, you're still not looking out for it, and that they're talking about it as part of their medical history. And I also really like learning about ibuprofen in kids for maintaining lung function. I thought that was a really interesting thing. Sometimes we overlook the simple measures that we have, and in contrast to methotrexate, right? So something, just a reminder that you can kind of see around, but has some pretty serious complications and need for respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for covering those. So now we're going to move on to one of the review articles that you'll find online if you go to the JAPA website. And this is brought to us by Judy Trescott, Elisa Abidi, Kelly Donkers, and Daria Seegers. They're all PAs. And we're going to get a little itchy maybe because we're going to talk about parasites in this review article. But parasites of people that we don't always think about, and parasites of people in the U.S., not just traveling to exotic locations. So if you feel the need to scratch or reach around a little bit, don't worry, you're not alone. Also, there are really great images in this article, so be sure to check them out online so that you can really see a comparison of what the parasites look like, what you might be looking for, and in comparison to what size they might be, right? Because definitely I think we might all have different ideas of what these parasites look like, and certainly our patients might as well. So the authors cover four specific parasites that are common in the U.S., and they point out that these are not linked to hygiene. Just because someone has acquired one of these parasites, they're common, but it doesn't mean that they did anything wrong. However, there's lots of stigma and there's lots of psychological stress, obviously, that goes along with being told that you have a parasite and following through with how to take care of that. So we're going to cover pinworms, head lice, scabies, and bed bugs. Pinworms, head lice, scabies, really common in kids. Bed bugs used to be on their way out, but now changing times have brought them back. So we're going to talk about these things in kind of that order. Pinworms are actually the most common infestation. They're not linked to age. They're not linked to socioeconomic status. They are linked to when you have direct contact with the eggs, though. And that can be toilet seats, bed clothes, toys. And if you get in contact with someone's nail beds who has pinworms and has been scratching because they're really itchy, apparently when females leave the anus to lay their eggs at night, and that happens specifically about 2 to 3 hours after someone has gone to sleep, that's actually when you're going to look for them too, which is fun for everyone, really, for the person being looked at and for the looker. Let's wake you up 2 to 3 hours after you've fallen asleep and look for pinworms. Awesome, but you got to do it. And what you're going to do is the tape test, right? You're going to get that transparent tape that you probably learned about and try to collect eggs around the anus, but you're going to do that for 3 days in a row. So after 3 days, someone's getting woken up 2 or 3 hours into their sleep. Probably going to have a cranky person. You want to do that either looking for them 2 or 3 hours after someone's gone to sleep, or use the transparent tape 3 days in a row right after they've woken up, the person's woken up, and before they've used the bathroom. Pinworms usually don't have any complications, but secondary infection can happen from someone scratching or if they've damaged their skin. But there are more rare complications like UTIs, GI infections, even appendicitis, and abdominal pain can occur. So think about pinworms in your differential when you're thinking about those presenting complaints. When you've diagnosed someone with pinworms, the medication that you use is mebendazole. And when you break that down, it's mebendazole. And I remember thinking about that in school as worms are bendy and bend is right there in that word. So it's a little memory trick that I thought of. Sorry, authors, to throw that in there for you. The over-the-counter meds seem to be less effective. And just a warning that mebendazole is category C. So for pregnancy or breastfeeding. It's recommended that someone shower instead of bathe to rinse any pinworms or the eggs down the drain. Anyone who lives or cares for the infected person should be treated. Wash everything with hot soap and water. And really, just kind of the way that Chris highlighted vaccines, and cystic fibrosis, wash your hands all the time. For pinworms or for anything else, we probably don't wash our hands enough. Anyone probably doesn't wash their hands enough. So really important, especially with pinworms. So now moving on to head lice. Really stressful for those who are infected. Stressful in the treatment and cleaning too, for if this is a kid, for the parents or caregivers who are working on getting rid of this infestation. It's again gained through direct contact. The lice bites and feeds on blood, and that's what causes itching. Again, anyone in the household needs to be treated, and retreatment after 7 to 9 days might be necessary if using the less potent medications like the pyrethrins or pipirinol. But the strong ovocytals, so killing of the ovum, like permethrin, kills lice and eggs for 2 weeks. What's really important along with the medication is hair combing and using a knit comb to get all of those knits and eggs out. Again, you're washing everything in hot water, drying it on high heat, and if it can't be washed, sticking it in a sealed plastic bag for at least 2 weeks. So sometimes those favorite items are going to be stuck in kind of quarantine for 2 weeks in a plastic bag. We're moving on to bed bugs. How fun, especially for those who really like to travel. They're flat, they're reddish brown. Definitely go back and look at the photos online. And what's fun about bed bugs is they can migrate about 100 feet. But the authors let us know that they usually stay within about 8 feet of where someone's sleeping. We thought we'd had these eradicated by the 40s, but like a lot of things, they came back. We moved on in technology and some of the older things have come back to remind us that they're still out there. Bed bugs cause itching. Again, a lot of stress, but bed bugs aren't a vector for disease that we really know about, the authors point out. You want to look for a linear pattern of bites. Here's something exciting. You might get to introduce a bed bug sniffing dog into the treatment here. It's always fun to bring a dog into treatment when you can. Not that you want to have bed bugs, but That could be a more fun part of getting rid of them or finding them. You might, well, finding them. I don't think that the dogs have been trained to get rid of them yet, but maybe someday. You might see the bugs. You might see their exoskeletons. You might see spots of blood in the sheets. You might smell a musty odor. The authors let us know. And the bites normally go away on their own, but we still need to get rid of them. And for that, you really need a professional exterminator. And even though after professional extermination, the authors let us know that most people end up just throwing that bedding out. And so last but not least, we move on to scabies, spread in close contact. Again, this is not a hygiene issue. Once the mite has gone under the skin, no amount of washing is going to get it out. So we really kind of want to protect our patients from over-excoriation and scrubbing, actually, because it's not going to be helpful. It's more common in early winter. And again, we're going to look for evidence of the bites. And these are those short, wavy burrow lines, specifically between fingers and toes, elbows, waist, penis, nipples, axilla, those nice warm spots. Kids might get a rash on palms, soles, and on their face. And just an aside, remember that rashes on palms and soles aren't that common, so keep scabies in your differential for that. Humans are really hypersensitive to mite, saliva, eggs, and feces, and so that's what makes scabies so itchy. One thing that the authors point out that a lot of people might not be as aware of is the crusting infection of scabies in people who are immunocompromised. And in those types of infections, there can be up to 2 million mites compared to the 20 mites that are usually seen in infections in those who are not immunocompromised. So that's going to be kind of just this huge infection. And it's obviously more easily spread because there's just so many more mites to be spread. Helping you in the diagnosis is to see if other family members and close contacts have the rash. So you're going to have to treat everyone. We're going to use permethrin, the 5% cream, and really apply it tip to toe, every surface, including scalp, all of the body, leaving it on for 8 to 12 hours. Lindane is reserved for really resistant infections. It's something that was used more commonly before Lindane 1%, but a reminder that it's associated with neurotoxic adverse reactions. So what's going to be really helpful, especially in all of these infections, is managing patient expectations, giving a lot of reinsurance, providing non-judgmental care, because remember, a lot of these are not, all of them are not associated with socioeconomic status, anything that someone did with the hygiene. So, but there's a lot of stigma and a lot of stress associated with them. So take care of your patients emotionally when you're treating their infections too. Treat the whole family, wash everything. And now have a quick scratch and we're going to move on to the quick recertification series.
So now we're going to jump into the quick recertification series and we're going to hit the pearls on stroke from Timothy Ferrarati, who actually serves on the PAEA end of rotation exam committee with me. So the pearls of stroke, 87% are ischemic, fourth leading cause of death in the U.S., 3% prevalence in the U.S. Risk factors that are associated with it. You have non-modifiable and modifiable. What does that mean? Non-modifiable, nothing you can do about it. Male gender, positive family history, specific genetic disorders are all things that can cause stroke, but we can't affect. Modifiable is where we come in and we earn our keep. So patients who have hypertension, diabetes, atrial fibrillation, hyperlipidemia, do they smoke, do they drink alcohol, sedentary lifestyle, these will have all have a positive correlation and causation with stroke and things that we can do and counsel our patients. So the clinical assessment of stroke is going to be a sudden onset of pain less neurologic deficit. Key, pain less neurologic deficit. 88% have some degree of the triad of facial weakness, arm weakness, and speech difficulty. Most common vessel that is affected is the middle cerebral artery, and this can cause contralateral hemiparesis and hemisensory of the face, arm greater than leg paralysis, aphasia, and my most favorite phrase in all of medicine, homonymous hemianopsia. The anterior cerebral artery is classically going to be legs greater than arms in terms of the weakness, and in your posterior cerebral artery, it's going to be more vision disturbances. Your vertebral basilar system is going to have a lot of cranial nerve abnormalities, so your physical exam is really going to help you pinpoint where on the brain you need to look when you get your CAT scan. Now, if there is pain associated with the sudden onset of neurologic deficit, think dissection. If there's syncope, think hemorrhagic, think a spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage from a barium aneurysm rupture. The most important clinical element is time of onset. You need to know when was the last time this patient was normal. You're going to use your National Institutes of Health, the NIH Stroke Scale Severity, which most emergency departments have forms that are readily available that you can use, because this will objectively evaluate the severity and, more importantly, help you trend this over time. Your diagnosis, things you're going to do, you're going to do a finger stick glucose, because a lot of hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia can mimic stroke-like symptoms, and this is something we can fix very quickly. We're going to do a non-contrasted head CT, because contrasted head CT is going to blur the blood that is in the brain, so you want to make sure very quickly, is this a bleed or no bleed? Diffusion-weighted MRI is the most sensitive and most specific for infarction, but not every institution is going to have it, and it's also very time-sensitive. These take a lot more time than a head CT, so you've got to weigh your times. Your treatment, intravenous fibrinolysis within 4.5 hours, as long as there's no contraindications, and the article goes into listing a few of those contraindications. You're going to treat hypertension if it's greater than 185 over 110 systolic if you're giving TPA, or greater than 220 over 120 if you are not. There are a lot of research and data coming out right now of other managements other than fibrinolysis, such as intra-arterial thrombolysis, mechanical thrombectomy, intracranial angioplasty, which are becoming much more prevalent in the community and may be options for patients who cannot receive fibrinolysis. You're going to admit these patients to comprehensive multidisciplinary stroke centers, which may be in your hospital, or they may need to be transferred. But go to the article for more details, as well as some quick recertification questions.
Yeah, thanks. Just a quick review, but something really important to consider when someone's coming in with any of those symptoms, not to be missed. So we're going to move into our second of the two CME articles that are in the May issue. And this one is about pain management, and specifically the evaluation and management of orofacial pain. Stephanie Joseph Goski, PA, and Francisco Plaza Villegas, DDS, came together, and I just want to kind of give a shout out to the interprofessional work between a PA and a dentist that went into this article. So, good for you guys, and a reminder to the rest of us to use all of our healthcare team. So, here, the thing is that the authors point out this is a really common complaint, and it can be really hard to diagnose correctly, hard to manage, and can be really expensive if you're not finding the underlying cause of this and diagnosing correctly. But there is so much anatomy in the head and neck and face. Really, these symptoms can be coming from so many different places. The authors break it down for us in that it can be dental or not. Dental pain is really common, especially in kids, so that's something that maybe you want to look for first. This article has several really great tables. Highly recommend that you go and check them out to summarize and remind you of the nerve innervation of the face, the cranial and the cervical nerves, and some great studies on the right H&P and red flags, cranial structures that are innervated and those that aren't. So the tables in this article really do a great job of laying out this problem for us. So they remind us, too, that the main sensory for the face is cranial nerve 5. So as you're thinking, maybe this is dental, also think, does this have something to do with a facial nerve? A cranial nerve, is this neurologic? But you're going to be thinking about the entire head and neck, inside and out. Now is a great time to page through that anatomy textbook again that you know has been sitting on your shelf for a while. So we're looking at the presentation first. Pain can match the site of the problem or not. Can really vary widely depending on the cause. And as usual, the answer can be found somewhere in the history, but the patient might not know what to volunteer to you or not. So your history taking, the mark of a PA, your history and physical, is really, really crucial here. Know that the facial pain, the authors remind us, can be associated with and can also cause a lot of psychologic stress. Your face is highly innervative. It's what you show to the world. So there's a lot of physical and psychological factors, and especially in orofacial pain, they're very linked. So here you really want to make sure that you're taking care of a patient's psychological health and doing a really thorough behavioral medicine, psychologic history as well, because it seems sometimes they can compound each other in orofacial pain. In physical exam, focus on point tenderness, any focal neurologic deficits, which is going to be a red flag. We're going to highlight those a little bit more. Changes in sensation or asymmetry. So moving on to how do we figure out what's going on? How do we diagnose it? First, we're going to look at odontogenic. Let me stumble over that word one more time. Odontogenic sources, so the teeth, dental causes, and know that dental decay is a major cause of orofacial pain. Hugely common, most common chronic disease in kids ages 6 to 19, and 9 out of 10 adults have some level of tooth root decay. So really big problems with our teeth, and then really big problems with our nutrition and chewing and TMJ issues. So let's look at dental causes first, and let's use our resources in the dental community and refer to dentists whenever we think there's something tooth going on. It can be non-tooth related, and then ask about previous radiation. Think about oral cancers, really common, TMJ. And then there are a slew of rare headaches and phantom pain, and then pain that has no known underlying cause. So it's getting a little gray and a lot blurry. Don't forget about tic de la rue, also known as trigeminal neuralgia, which is going to be an issue of cranial nerve 5. Glossopharyngeal neuralgia is rare, less known than trigeminal neuralgia, and really often misdiagnosed. So that glossopharyngeal nerve causing some ruckus. That's really important not to miss, though, because the authors point out that glossopharyngeal neuralgia is associated with a lethal cardiac dysrhythmia. So in orofacial pain, think about one of those as one of the lethal things that you can't miss. And then, of course, the other things that you can't miss, kind of going back to the quick research that Chris just reviewed for us, are the vascular and non-vascular diseases like ischemic, cerebrovascular disease, hemorrhages, AV malformations. So here are some of the red flags that you want to think about. Is there temporal pain, and are we thinking temporal arteritis? Is this progressive pain? Is it new onset? Are there focal neurologic signs? Is it increasingly getting worse, or is it associated with nausea or vomiting or early morning symptoms? Is there hearing loss? Any changes in balance? And just a reminder, outside of the articles, change in balance can be stroke, so think about that. Is there ear pain, altered sensation? And then the authors bring out the American Headache Society tool of SNOOP as an acronym to screen for life-threatening disorders associated with headache. So SNOOP stands for systemic symptoms or disease, neurologic signs or symptoms. The first O is for onset. Was it sudden? The second O, onset, is it after age 40? And have there been any pattern changes? So they're all red flags for headaches. The management and prognosis obviously is going to totally depend on the underlying cause, but we really need thorough pain management. We really need this to be multidisciplinary. And if there's acute pain, it's often dental. Call in your favorite dentist and manage patient expectations, because we might not be totally able to eliminate the pain, but we're looking to control it as much as possible. And outside of the great article that the authors have provided here for us, I just want to remind everyone that the AAPA has an oral health initiative to promote the education of and improvement of oral health across the United States. So as PAs, we're really situated to make a big difference in our patients' lives, and just thinking about their dental care as part of someone's overall care can be really important here, especially when you're thinking about a cause for orofacial pain. So there we go. So we're going to come back to how we're celebrating this 50th anniversary of the PA profession. So glad to be here on this cusp of moving forward into a new era. As we're looking forward, we're also looking back, and there are a couple great features in this issue this month, celebrating the 50th anniversary and highlighting some original research. And the first one that we're going to talk about is highlighted, brought to us by Dane, Everett, and Hooker, really prominent names in the PA world, in the PA research world. And this section on the 50th anniversary series is edited by Ruth Ballweg, Rima Bouchard, and Tanya Gregory. So thanks to them for bringing us these highlights. And so really we're looking at the first article, Research on the PA Profession, the Medical Model Shifts. And the authors bring us through the history of research on the PA profession and how there's a lot out there that really supports what a great profession this is, how it's come to fit needs in the United States, and later we're going to talk about all across the world, and how the type of research that we've done has highlighted different benefits that the PA profession brings. But that moving forward, we really have to think about where is the next level of research going to come from. And as we move through as in our profession, an ever-changing healthcare setting, how are we evolving? How are we showing with research, with evidence, our benefit and the impacts that we're making? So at the end of the article, the authors really call for the next generation of researchers to step forward and highlight that we should be thinking about bringing up that next generation and contributing. So a call to all of us to contribute more to the data that supports our profession, or data that investigates our profession. So looking backwards and forwards at the same time, I think, is really exactly what the 50th anniversary is about. And we thank the authors for that contribution.
Absolutely. Can't do anything without data. And the more PAs we have out there contributing to it, the farther our profession is going to go.
Right.
The next two articles that are highlighted in this particular special 50th anniversary revolve around PA practice in Mississippi. The first article that is in the hard print is Last But Not Least, PA Practice in Mississippi, which was written by Tristan Harris and Kenneth Butler, who are both out of the PA program at the Mississippi College in Clinton, Mississippi. And they talk about the history of how they fought for the rights of physician assistants getting practice in Mississippi, culminating to the legislature passed in 2000 that gave practice authority to PAs in the state as the last state in the country to allow it. And then this is followed up by one of the online articles where there's three PAs talking about the successes in Mississippi. So a little bit more of a verbal banter about how this all transpired, kind of where we how it progressed in the state, and ultimately how they were able to win the legislature that allowed PAs to practice. So I think you definitely need to go and check that out so you can see exactly how this occurred in the last state to allow for practice authority for physician assistants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we've made such great strides, but there's going to be lots of challenges ahead of us. So looking back to see how we've overcome is going to shine light on how we can continue to move forward. So another great online article celebrating our 50th anniversary and going back to research about the benefits of PAs are from our colleagues in the Netherlands, Koos Meijer and Lupo Kuhlman. And excuse me, my Dutch isn't great, so I'm not sure if I've gotten your names perfect, but I hope that we hear more of them, because they've brought us some good research to show that PAs have been used in the Netherlands for some time. And there's in about 8,700 GP practices and in the 5,500 GP offices in the Netherlands. So they're not all there, but in as of 2017, there were about 1,000 PAs employed in a wide variety of settings and specialties, the authors let us know. So that's a pretty big chunk. That's, I don't know, maybe about one in five offices, one in eight offices, just an estimate. And so using some set standards, the authors were investigating patient satisfaction with PAs in the Netherlands. And you might not be surprised to find out that in general, PAs are really well received. Patients seem to be really satisfied with the care that they receive by PAs, and just as satisfied as the care they receive from GPs. The authors point out their limitations, like any good research should. And one is that consultation time wasn't taken into consideration as much. Is it that PAs can spend more time with the patients? And of course, we want to do that, and patients want that too. But in general, it looks like this model transfers to different countries, and providing more care where it's needed always seems like a benefit. So thanks for that contribution. So we can see how PAs are expanding and being used worldwide. And that's an online article too. So when you're going to read about three PAs talking about their success in Mississippi, look to success in the Netherlands as well while you're there.
We're going to close out this particular edition with the Art of Medicine piece by Harrison Reed, who is the deputy editor of JAPA. where he is going to actually be reading his piece entitled Saying Goodnight.
The clock strikes 7, and my brain turns back into a pumpkin. All of the stressors of my shift, held at bay for 12 hours by a sense of duty, a focus on the immediate, tumble from their hiding places. There's the coffee I spilled down my scrubs before the day began, a new admission that rolled into the unit without warning just as I arrived, the needle that refused to find the tiny, throbbing hint of an artery in my patient's wrist. There's the unexpected computer system downtime, the family feud that erupted in the lobby, and the specialist who delivered his expertise in a curt, sarcastic package. By the end of the day, the pile of those small offenses feels like a mountain, and the handful of victories are forgotten gems buried in the mess. My relief arrives, fresh for the night shift and ready to start building her own mountain. I hand off the remnants of my work, pack up my stethoscope, and grab my coat. See you tomorrow, my coworker says. After an exhausting day, the pleasantry feels like a cruel taunt. Yeah, I say. See ya. There are fewer than 12 hours before my next shift starts, and after accounting for time to travel, eat, and sleep, it might make more sense to pitch a tent in the cafeteria. I remember reading about a girl who quit her job in New York City to scoop ice cream in the Caribbean. Maybe she knows something the rest of us don't. Who doesn't love ice cream? My legs are on cruise control, and I'm almost to the massive revolving doors guarding my path to freedom when a thought springs from my subconscious. My brain tells my feet to stop, and they're only too happy to comply. I turn 90 degrees to my right, away from the exit, and walk deeper into the hospital. Somewhere in the muddled mind is an image of a man with striking eyes, light brown speckled with bits of sky blue, like they were crafted by a delirious, indecisive genius. I only saw them for a moment as I pushed his stretcher into the OR. They'd fluttered open when his daughter whispered into his ear, flashed with a moment of recognition, and closed again. Earlier today, I left that man while his heart struggled in his chest, his fate no longer in my hands. Now, as night settles on the hospital and the drone of activity no longer echoes through the halls, I make my way back toward that same OR. But just before the restricted doors, I veer toward a room with soft light, padded chairs, and hushed voices. My eyes scan each of the hopeful faces that turn my way, searching for someone familiar. I find her in the far corner. I pick my way through the waiting room, a campground of families starving for good news. I reach my patient's daughter before I have time to wonder why I'm not halfway home, why I felt compelled to make this pilgrimage. But as I stand in front of her, she looks up and smiles. "You again," she says. "Yeah, me," I say. "How is he?" "They say he did well," she said. "He's not out of the woods, but he did well." Relief bubbles from my stomach and catches in my throat. That mountain I tried to carry out of the hospital, forgotten for a moment. "I'm glad to hear that," I say. "Thank you," she says, "for everything you did for him." "You're welcome," I say, wondering if I've justified my intrusion into this fragile place. I just wanted to wish you luck and say goodnight. She nods. "Goodnight." In a moment, I'll retrace my path back to the hospital atrium and my ever-diminishing reprieve from work. I'll rewind my day in my head as I cook dinner or more likely stop somewhere for takeout. I'll turn the TV to a random channel to fill the air with conversations that have nothing to do with medicine or disease. I'll consider scooping ice cream in the Caribbean. But there'll be a sense of levity that didn't exist before, a buoyancy in my chest. For me, it was an accidental discovery, like penicillin or silly putty. But I have a tiny cure for the mountain that tries to follow me home. Find someone who carries an even heavier weight and has even further to go. Put away the stethoscope, look them in the eyes, grasp their hand, and say goodnight.
So with that, we would like to thank you all for joining us on this inaugural episode. We would like to send out a special thank you to JAPA for allowing us to record this podcast and hopefully continue doing this with each of the monthly installments of JAPA moving forward. We'd like to thank the contributing authors for, of course, submitting their articles to JAPA and allowing us to do the review and doing the podcast on them, as well as the editorial and publishing team for supporting this endeavor. The list is huge, and there are a lot of heavy hitters. So I really encourage you to go to the first page of the journal for a list of these amazing professionals, because there's just way too many to name.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. And thank you for listening. And aside from listening, we want to remind you to check out the diagnostic imaging review. Images don't show up so great on podcasts, so you're going to need to see them for yourself. Other great articles and features that we didn't get to cover. But as you're headed off to JAPA, we hope that you'll head back to us next month and subscribe and meet us back here. So thanks for listening.
Thank you all for listening. We'll see you back again next month.
Bye.
Bye.